The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Republican primary debates are getting rowdier with each installment. Insults and accusations were flying at the debate in Detroit hosted by Fox News. But the most talked about exchange was a gesture. Marco Rubio and Donald Trump wiggling their fingers in the air to show how big their hands are. The crude comparison was met with a mix of bemusement and disgust. American voters and pundits wondered why our politicians can't be more dignified, more civilized, like the Europeans or the Brits.
I ask my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister.
Last week, like him, I was in Brussels meeting with heads of government and leaders of European socialist parties, one of whom said to me,
that's absolutely vital. I'll ask my mother. Oh, I think I know what my mother would say. I think she'd look across the dispatch box and she'd say, put on a proper suit, do up your tie, and sing the national anthem.
That's a clip of a montage of parliamentary insults put together by The Washington Post. Adam Taylor covers foreign affairs for The Post and wrote about the longstanding tradition of being petty, mean, and deliciously rude in the British Parliament. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me on.
So these are all relatively recent clips from Parliament, which is right now debating mostly the Brexit or the decision on whether or not Britain should leave the European Union. Is this unusually raucous?
I would say tensions are a little heightened, but there's certainly a long tradition of these sort of insults and raucous back and forth in Parliament.
How did that begin?
You know, it goes back really as long as we can measure. It goes back into the 18th century. And one of the things is like the very nature of Parliament, it's sort of confrontational. So it's one side of the government sits on one side and then the opposition sits on the other side. And famously, they are the distance between the two front benches is supposed to be two swords' lengths, which gives you an idea of what they expected might happen. From what I understand, things really got in sort of the modern era got very bad in the 70s when there was sort of personal animosity between Harold Wilson and Edward Heath, and it's just kind of continued to this day.
I'm stunned. I mean, that was Prime Minister David Cameron there talking about what his mother would say. Now, what is the context for that? How does something like that come up on the floor of Parliament?
Well, in that case, they were talking about cuts to the health service, and I believe that David Cameron was talking about the proposed budget cuts when a Labour MP actually shouted out, "Ask your mum," which is a reference to the fact that Cameron's own mother had signed a petition opposing the cuts. I think that's more indicative of just really how everyone sort of shouts out. These take place during Prime Minister's questions time, and when basically Parliament's full, it's sort of standing room only, and there's really sort of an atmosphere of sort of like a debate at a pub or something. There's people shouting stuff out and sort of trying to get the upper hand and cheering and jeering, and it's very confrontational.
Well, I mean, I know that isn't quite a yo mama joke, but it is pretty hard to imagine President Obama responding to or even being thrown such a kind of insult. How do you compare this to the kind of sniping that we hear here in the U.S.?
I think one of the things that is very different is that this is kind of institutionalized in the UK. So a lot of what we see is taking place during the Prime Minister's questions times, which take place every Wednesday for half an hour while Parliament's in session. And it's really sort of the focal point of like British public debate. You know, it's televised and it's very popular, and really all these insults tend to come from that. And it's partly as well, you know, this is a parliamentary system. So David Cameron is the leader of the Conservatives in Parliament and the Conservative government in Parliament. So he's in there asking questions. And, you know, it's a chance for him to sort of not just show off his policy, but also show off sort of his wit and his confidence. A lot of these politicians rose up through Oxford and Cambridge, where they have very strong debating unions, which I think also plays into this.
Yeah. And also, it sounds like a lot of their clever little snipes are sort of made for Twitter. How is it doing in the social media age?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It seems to have had a sort of a resurgence in the past few years. David Cameron, in particular, is very good at it. He's actually, in my opinion, he's a very good public speaker. I would very much assume all of this stuff is pre-prepared. But he also has a sort of way of saying this stuff in a way that makes it seem very, very sort of off the cuff. And, you know, it does work in terms of, like, sort of the cable news era. You know, Britain has a very similar sort of system of 24-hour rolling news, and stuff like this makes headlines. And the worst that's really going to happen, you know, is the Speaker of the House can reprimand you, in which case you have to withdraw the comment. Certain comments get more withdrawn than others. For example, you're not allowed to call someone a liar. That always has to be withdrawn.
So let's hear just a clip. This is actually a comment that I guess went too far and was asked to be withdrawn.
Of using our hard-won credibility, which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me.
I'm very worried about the health of the health minister, who's so overexcited he might suffer a relapse, and I'm a compassionate chap. I don't want that to happen. But the Prime Minister will please withdraw the word idiot. It's unparliamentary. A simple withdrawal will suffice. We're grateful.
So what happens when they're withdrawn? Are they stricken from the record? What's the result?
It's essentially like that, yeah. They have to withdraw it, and they have to apologize. I mean, it's not a severe reprimand, you know. As you'll see from these clips, quite often the speaker is laughing himself and sort of playing along into it.
Is this just theater, though, Adam? I mean, you know, afterwards, are they all sort of patting each other in the back in the pub?
To a degree. I'm sure there is some significant personal animosity here. But, you know, Britain is a small country, and all these guys live in London, or most of the time live in London. And a lot of them, you know, went to the same colleges. They all went. A lot of people go to Oxford and Cambridge, and a lot of them know each other from their university years. So while there is a sort of personal animosity, I think it's a bit different from the US, where they know each other well, and they also sort of live in the same world, and which is partly, I guess, why some of the insults are so cutting.
Well, it is the personal nature of the attacks that many Americans have, you know, watching these debates among the Republicans, especially, and the Democrats as well, thought, you know, this is, you've just going too far. So should Americans looking to Europe, you know, for inspiration for a more civilized government reconsider?
Well, certainly. I certainly don't think that European politics is much more civilized. Obviously, I know the British example very well, and there's insults flying around everywhere, and very personal insults, and very cutting and sometimes quite mean insults. And I, you know, my impression of the rest of the continent is that it's not much better there either. You know, the big question is whether these insults overshadow serious debates. I'm of two minds about that. I'm not really sure they do or they do not. They certainly make people pay more attention, which could be a good thing.
Adam Taylor, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Adam Taylor reports on foreign affairs for The Washington Post and wrote the article, "The Petty, Mean, and Deliciously Rude Way British Politicians Insult One Another." You can find the article and find a terrific montage of Brits having it out at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tropical Storm Irene, Hurricane Sandy, the Blizzard of 78. There are a handful of storms that New Englanders will never forget, but none compared to the hurricane of 1938, a storm that made landfall on Long Island and then carved an unprecedented path of destruction up through Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire. Hundreds of people were killed, and damages were in what would now be the billions of dollars. But what really took the brunt of the storm were New England forests. Stephen Long is founder and former editor of Northern Woodlands magazine, and he's out with a new book called 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. And he's joining us now from the studios at Dartmouth. Stephen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
Stephen, how strong by today's standards was the hurricane of 38?
Well, we've never seen anything like it. I mean, we have had hurricanes that have come up into this area, but by the time they've reached here, they've lost all of their wind. So We had tremendous flooding from Irene. It was really a terrible, terrible storm, particularly in Vermont. But it was all rain. It was a slow-moving storm that dumped a whole bunch of rain. 38 was a hurricane that came up on a northern path all the way into New Hampshire and Vermont and brought 100-mile-an-hour winds to this area. I mean, we've never seen 100-mile-an-hour winds. And that followed a weather system that had been here for a week or so, and it had dumped 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of rain. So totally unrelated to the hurricane, there was flooding conditions already on the ground. And so if the hurricane had never come through, it would have been the event would have been known as the flood of 1938. But 100-mile-an-hour winds is unprecedented.
Well, today we have inventories, we have modeling that shows us, at least to some degree, what kind of damage a big storm could do if it hit us. But back in 1938, New Englanders had no concept of what a powerful storm could do. What did that mean and how it all played out?
Now, you know, when the late summer, early fall comes around, we're all sort of watching the Weather Channel. If we hear that there's a storm coming, a hurricane coming, we prepare for it. But the 38 hurricane was absolutely a stunning event that no one had the slightest idea was even a possibility. There had been a generation or two had gone by since the last hurricane hit New England. And so the Boston Globe, the next morning after the hurricane hit, called it New England's first hurricane. Now, that's amazing to us to think that there could have been a time when we were not aware that hurricanes could hit here. But and I'm talking about not just up here, but down on the coast. The coast had not experienced a hurricane for about 60 or 70 years.
So they had no record. The cost to infrastructure was then about $300 million, $5 billion in today's money. How much damage did New Hampshire's forests endure?
New Hampshire's forests were particularly hard hit. Out of the 2.6 billion board feet that went down, a great percentage of it was in New Hampshire. New Hampshire was in a particularly vulnerable situation right then because it had a lot of white pine throughout the state, and white pine was particularly vulnerable. It was tall enough at that time. The economy, we were in the midst of the Depression. The 20s weren't any kinder to the forest-based economy. And so trees had had considerable time to grow, and they were tall, and they went down everywhere the wind blew. What happened, interestingly enough, was this hurricane, this tremendous devastation, actually ended up breathing new life into the forest products industry.
Yeah, I'd love to know more about that. But first, just want to picture, you say 2.6 billion board feet of wood. Now, what does that look like?
Sure. If you've been out on an interstate behind a log truck, you're following 6,000 board feet. And so if you make almost 500,000 of those trucks, picture that, and that's what blew down.
You also point out that it would take New England's biggest sawmill operating today 29 years to process that much lumber.
That's right.
So, yeah. So if you're taking a walk in a New Hampshire forest today, can you see the remnants of the 38 hurricane in the landscape?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's signs of it everywhere. The most obvious sign would be what's called pit and mound topography. And what that is when a tree blows over, its roots rip out of the ground, the soil and the rocks, and it creates a hole. And then over time, as the wood of the root system disintegrates, it creates a mound. And so if you see a preponderance of this pit and mound topography, you can pretty much guarantee that it was the hurricane. And one way of being absolutely certain is to look at the direction. So if you stand in the pit and look out over the mound, you should be looking somewhere to the north or northwest. And in that case, that means that the wind was behind you, south or southeast, and that was the wind that did all the damage.
We're talking about the devastating hurricane that hit New England in 1938 and felled 2.6 billion board feet of timber, an awful lot, by the way, and caused approximately $5 billion of today's dollars in damage. Stephen Long is with us. He's the author of 38. How did the felling of all this lumber reverberate throughout the New England economy at the time? Like, who suffered from that? Who benefited from all of this wood?
Well, it was an unprecedented amount of wood on the ground. Throughout New England, it represented five times the amount of the annual harvest. Without any action taken by the government, people would have really been in a terrible bind because there's this glut of wood on the ground, and people who had counted on this as their savings bank were in great jeopardy. So what happened was the U.S. Forest Service and the WPA and CCC came in as part of the Northeast Timber Salvage Administration. The government set up a program, A, to clean up the brush, because people were really—
Right, the real danger of forest fires.
Very, very frightened about forest fires. And B, set up a system by which they would buy delivered wood, delivered logs. And then by doing that, there was a need for sawmills to saw the wood into lumber. There was a need for loggers to bring the wood to the mills. And so it was actually quite a boon to people in a situation where there was great, great possibility for what would have been a total loss.
So sawmills were set up everywhere. And this is thanks to the federal government in this case, you know, part of Roosevelt's alphabet soup, as they call it, all of these federal agencies that came together. What do you think the response would be today if a hurricane of that magnitude struck New England? How would things be different? How would it manifest today?
Well, things would be terribly different for a number of reasons. One, there's almost twice the number of people living in the stricken area as there were. There was about 9 million people in the area. Now there's 17 million. So many, many more people would be affected. There's the forests themselves are more mature. There, more area is covered with forest, particularly in Vermont. Vermont was at that time probably 45% forested. Now it's 80%. New Hampshire is 80-85%. So there would be more mature trees ready to blow down. There's so much more infrastructure in place. All the roads, everything would be covered just like it was back then. But there would be much less likelihood that the federal government would step in the way that they did at the time. Another sort of a similarity to that time is that the forest products industry at this time is they're probably harvesting the same amount of wood they were 10 or 15 years ago, but that's being done by fewer people. So the companies are larger and there are fewer loggers out there doing this work. So if you have this time around, instead of 30,000 landowners in jeopardy, this time around you have more like 100,000. There aren't 100,000 loggers, and they're just not going to appear in time to get this done. So it'll probably be more of a situation where people are having to pay to have this work done. No one's going to be made whole unless they already have a good relationship with a logger who can get to their land and take care of it.
Decimated forests, new federal programs, sawmills all over the countryside, all in the Depression era, and this is pre-World War II America. What do you think, Stephen Long, the legacy of the 38 hurricane was on the character of New England and its citizens?
Well, the way that people came together in a private-public partnership, I think, was quite a rallying event for people. So they turned devastation into a success story in a lot of ways. I think that people ended up feeling like they'd turned lemons into lemonade and had survived something totally unprecedented.
Stephen Long, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much.
Stephen Long, he's founder and former editor of Northern Woodlands magazine. His book is called 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This may not have been the best year for skiers in New England, but there is no shortage of snow in the backcountry of Wyoming. This next story of man versus machine versus nature comes to us from the folks at Human Nature.
I don't know in the 21st century if we believe in like the evil eye and believe in curses and stuff, but I felt like I did something wrong.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is Human Nature, real stories where humans and our habitat meet. I'm Caroline Ballard. In this episode, we'll hear about a man whose wish came true. But you know what they say, be careful what you wish for. Micah Schweitzer and his wife were on a backcountry ski trip in the Snowy Range Mountains in southern Wyoming.
Once you're up there and in the cabin and have the wood stove going and you can go out for a little ski behind the cabin in the trees where there's no wind, it's so beautiful and so peaceful. And I feel like going up there for 24 hours, you feel like you've been gone for a week. You know, time moves so slowly, and it's just the most spectacular experience to be up there. On Friday morning, you know, we had breakfast and packed up and everything and skied out. And Thursday, it was dead silent. Like, I think we were the only people up there. And on Friday, we start hearing and seeing snowmobiles. I'll be honest, I'm not a fan of snowmobiles, right? I think that when you start taking large machines into these pristine mountains, you lose something. Somebody told me that now the snowmobiles are creating paths that foxes can walk up, and they can go places they couldn't have gone before because of deep snow, and they're starting to damage the rodent populations higher up in the mountains. So the whole balance gets thrown off, and, you know, not to mention all the noise and the fumes. And so I'm not a fan of snowmobiles. I don't really get the appeal. And when I'm on skis in this quiet, pristine place, I just feel like it sort of taints it. And so we're skiing out on Friday, and it's not like there were, you know, a couple of snowmobiles. That's fine. There were, I think, between 30 and 40. We skied for 45 minutes from the cabin down to where the roads closed to our car, and I think we saw between 30 and 40 snowmobiles passing us or being unloaded. And I think it was the long weekend, people coming up, huge trucks pulling trailers. One guy had, you know, like a whiskey flask attached to the back of his backpack. Hmm. And it's just, I don't know, it's just like you're driving this enormous mechanized vehicle into the mountains and you're potentially boozing it up while you're doing, like, I don't know. It just seemed like a metaphor for what my prejudice would say is like an irresponsible pastime. And it made me angry, that amount of noise, and I'm like, you know, skiing through clouds of fumes. And I refused to wave at anybody. And I got angry about it. And I would not get out of the way. I'd force them. I figured they could either hit me or get out of my way. And Liberty, my wife, was also not a fan. And so we were getting grumpy about this, all these snowmobiles passing us. And then I said, I hope one of them hits a tree. And she said, "Why would you wish that on a tree?" And I said, "Okay, I hope one of them hits a rock." And I think I left it there at that point. But then a little while later, you know, another however many snowmobiles had passed us, and I finally said, "I hope one of them hits a rock and dies." And Liberty said, "Don't say that. That's bad karma." And I said, you know, whatever it takes to have fewer snowmobiles polluting these mountains. So that's Friday morning. Wednesday evening, I'm about to leave work. I'm taking one last look at my Twitter feed, and I see this news story come through from a Wyoming newspaper about a person who died in the snowies. And I click on it, and it's a snowmobiler. So a family of three, a mother, a father, and a son, drove up into the snowies. They parked at Green Rock, where the road ends, which is like the same place that we parked to ski in. On the newspaper website, they had a map. It was the seeing that map tune, like, oh my gosh, I was just there. And they went snowmobiling, and one of their snowmobiles broke down. And they couldn't leave where they were because the winds were so bad and the ground blizzards were so bad and there's so much blowing snow. So they built a snow cave and a fire and sheltered in place Saturday night. I mean, I'd be terrified to spend the night up there in winter. It is so harsh. You know, you're at 10,000 plus feet. It gets so cold. And then on Sunday, the father hears a snowmobile in the distance. He gets on a second snowmobile to go find help. And that snowmobile gets stuck, like I think in a body of water or something. So he goes back and gets the third snowmobile, and he's on that, and the handles break. And then he has to build a snow cave and stay Sunday night alone, and his wife and son are in the other snow cave. And I'm sure search and rescue has been alerted by now, but they find him on Monday and then have to call off the search because of blizzard conditions, ground blizzards. And so I think on Tuesday they finally found the son and the mother had died, exposure or something. And the son had frostbite and had to be airlifted to a hospital. So I read this story, and like, they're real people. You know, they're not just, I don't know, some, what I would have seen as like some reckless dude with his whiskey flask and his big machine, you know, polluting the mountains. Like this is a family. The woman was only 46. She's an 18-year-old son. And especially hearing about the husband. Like he hears the snow, help is so close, and then you have these snowmobiles that break down, and he's like, how helpless he was. It was, for me to read that, to think that, you know, the day before, 2 days before they're going through this, that I was saying, I hope somebody dies, made me, I guess I didn't think of them as real people, you know? And like, these are real people.
How did you tell your wife?
Well, I didn't want to at first. The thing that I said came true. I didn't want to shoulder that responsibility, and I felt like telling somebody would make that real somehow. And so I, we were just talking over dinner, and of course she made the connection immediately. She was like, "You cursed them. You said you hoped a snowmobiler would die, and now you're telling me that you just read in the newspaper that a snowmobiler died."
Do you feel responsible?
Not in a logical cause and effect fashion, but like, I cursed snowmobilers. I spoke a curse. And so when I read that, I felt very strange when I read that. I opened it up just thinking, oh my gosh, you know, these wilderness accidents happen. And then it says snowmobile in there. And I actually felt sort of shaky, very unsettled. Like, what are the odds? You know, you say this thing. I just said that I was just, you know, I was irritated, right? You say this thing, I was pissed off. I say this thing, move on with life. And then the next day, it happened. I don't come off of this looking like a good person, right? I feel this should be out there. I don't do this. This is not my what I do. I don't have a bad day and, you know, or have a bad interaction with someone and routinely curse them. It's not how I approach life.
Do you normally believe in curses?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a long history of curses. I mean, you look at any, you know, any culture's folklore or just stories. You look at the Bible. I don't know, in the 21st century, if we believe in like the evil eye and believe in curses and stuff. But I felt like I did something wrong, something bad. I don't know, you put that kind of energy out into the world or something, and that's not, it doesn't make a better world, right? It doesn't make things better.
Will this change how you talk about snowmobilers, or not even just snowmobilers, anybody?
I don't know if I'm ever going to be a fan of snowmobiles, right? It's just a different way of experiencing the world than I like. But to conflate that with the person who's on it, you know, to say I'm not a big fan of this machine, but then to somehow say that then the person who is using the machine is bad or is someone that I reject.
Or deserves to die.
I mean, that's where it all breaks down, right? Because if you take it so far as saying, I don't like this machine, I don't like who's on it because they're using the machine. I mean, you can take that far enough where you do say they deserve to die, and of course they don't. It's really humbling, not just humbling, but you know, I feel shame. And yeah, I don't think I'll do that again. I don't think I'll say that again.
And that story was told by producer Micah Schweitzer. The host of Human Nature is Caroline Ballard. You can learn more about the podcast at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Consumer drones, the one you can buy at a hobby store and fly with a remote control, are pretty impressive these days.
Oh, it's got built-in GPS maps?
Yeah.
Holy s***!
But super high-tech doesn't mean foolproof.
Wow.
Look at that wall.
Wow.
In case you couldn't tell, that was the sound of a very expensive drone flying into a brick wall. A Chinese company called DJI has just released a new cutting-edge consumer drone, the Phantom 4, that may just put a dent in these sorts of cringeworthy drone crashes so well documented on YouTube. Wall Street Journal's personal tech columnist Jeffrey Fowler had a chance to try it out, and he's with us to give us a sense of what this and other consumer drones are now capable of. We reached him via Skype. Jeffrey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the Phantom 4. What can it do that previous models could not?
The Phantom 4 is the first drone that stops idiot pilots from being idiots. And it turns out that many of us, myself included, are idiots. I have destroyed a number of drones in my day as a tech reviewer, flying them into trees, the side of buildings, you name it. And the DJI Phantom 4 has the ability to, on its own, decide, wait a minute, there is a tree or a wall or some other kind of obstacle in front of me, and then just stop and hover midair, or stop for a moment and then move around the object on its own safely and then continue its trajectory.
That's amazing. How does it do it?
It's called computer vision, and it is one of these things that the tech world has talked about for a long time, but we're actually starting to get in things like drones and also now cars. So it's got a whole series of cameras built into the drones that in a certain field of view can see obstacles in three dimension because they've got multiple cameras. And when you have multiple cameras, just like our eyeballs, you can see in 3D. And it's constantly making a map of the world around it. And if it senses that there is something in front of it, it's just going to stop and not let you run into it.
Something I found amazing, it also, does it follow targets? Do I have that right?
Yeah, so this is another big kind of dream that many of us who love these flying cameras have always wanted. We want our own flying paparazzi, right? We want somebody to, as we, you know, ski or go for a run or a beautiful sunset selfie, something in the sky to just follow us around. Now, other technologies that have tried this required you to maybe carry a special device with you that was transmitting your location back to the drone in the sky. What the DJI Phantom 4 does is it uses those extra cameras to create a visual lock on you and just follow you around with all those eyeballs.
Well, I guess the you is provisional here. It could be you or someone else that it follows.
It could be, yes. It could be you. It could be someone else. It could be a car. It could be a bike. You name it. But it certainly, I would say, there are lots of questions that drones raise, and one of them is privacy. None of these yet would be very good stalking mechanisms. These things sound like a horde of angry bees swarming nearby. And also the cameras on them are pretty wide angles, so you really couldn't do much spying with it, though obviously one could imagine that could happen in the future.
Well, let's go back to the crashes, which are not just disappointing and expensive for the drone owner. They can also be dangerous. In December, there was a much passed around video of a drone nearly smashing into a professional skier during a race in Italy. You can hear the gasp of the commentators in this clip. Is DJI, this Chinese company, trying to get ahead of concerns about consumer drones being unsafe for the public?
Yeah, I think that is probably one of the top concerns about drones out there. They first came out and everyone was like, wow. And then they kind of went through they're now in the trough period of what we got here in Silicon Valley called the hype cycle, right? Where people starting to realize, gosh, but these things, they go places they're not supposed to go. They crash into things. They're kind of dangerous. So DJI, which is pretty much the biggest drone maker out there, really wants to be able to say, no, these things are actually going to be intelligent enough in the future to stop even idiots.
How much is DJI's Phantom 4?
It's going to be $1,400, which is, frankly, a lot more than other drones out there. I think they gave it a premium price because it's got this fancy new technology. But I suspect we'll start to see this come down over time.
Jeffrey, you have been able to review a handful of drones. Are there big differences in the ways that they handle?
Yeah, and there's also big differences in the way that they handle the safety question. Another one that's really common with consumers, and that I've provisionally recommended to folks before, is made by a company called Parrot. Their drones, which cost about $500 or $600, are much more like toys. Those blades that they've got in them aren't nearly as fast, and they actually even ship with some guardrails around the blades so that if they, you can even fly it indoors. The DJI Phantom, you know, it's a serious flying machine. This thing can go up to 45 miles an hour and can go really high in the sky. And to show you how scary that can be, I actually did a little test with a hot dog where I stuck a hot dog into the blades of the Phantom 4, and you can bet the hot dog did not make it. But the Phantom 4 is doing just fine. So some other drone makers on the lower end are sort of basically saying, hey, we'll survive the hot dog test. Our blades are designed to automatically stop when they go. But the problem is at that price point, they really can't bring you the intelligence that would keep you from getting into an accident in the first place.
Well, we're calling them consumer drones, but who is the consumer for this technology and what are they using the drones for?
Yeah, so I live in San Francisco, which is the capital of Tech La La Land. And out here in Tech La La Land, drones are a thing. You can go to a public park or a beach and you'll see lots of hobbyist pilots out there. I think the problem that drones have had is that there's two groups that are interested, right? So there's the people that have always wanted to fly model airplanes, and those people are interested in flying. And then there's people more like me who are really just interested in photography. These things can produce amazing images. Your wedding pictures or your vacation in an amazing location looks totally different. And that is really what's bringing in people is the photography. But us photographers really don't have a lot of interest in flying. And so that's where the safety part comes in. Is there a way to make these things good even for people that really just want awesome pictures?
Well, we're in New Hampshire, which is not Tech La La Land, certainly, and drones are still a somewhat rare hobby. Do you see a day when a consumer drone like the Phantom 4 might be a household item?
Well, I'll give you this example. You know the company GoPro?
Yes.
They came out with what was essentially another version of something everybody already had, which was a camera on their smartphone. And yet they have proven that there is a market for standalone cameras that can go places that and do things that your smartphone wouldn't. And I think that's the drone market is going to tap the same thing. And no surprise, GoPro is actually working on their own drone. They say it's going to come out later this year. So I think part of the idea of this going a little bit more mainstream is just making these things easier to fly and maybe even getting rid of the word drone. We tend to, when we hear that, we tend to think, you know, missile strikes in the Middle East or something quite terrifying. And in fact, you see when, as GoPro talks about this product that hasn't come out yet, they're not even using the word drone. They're calling it a quadcopter or a flying camera. So I think there's a little bit of a marketing thing that's going to go on here as well as a technological one that just makes them much simpler to fly.
Jeffrey Fowler, personal technology columnist at The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for speaking with us.
You bet.
Thanks so much for taking the time to listen. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen to the show anytime you'd like by downloading the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, show us some love. Leave a rating on iTunes. And that's how it works, right? Sharing things by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.